Thank you, Mr. Hummel, and good afternoon once again to everyone. A few weeks ago, I started a two-part sermon and didn't get to do part two, but I'm back again to do part two this afternoon, I guess. Sometimes we as Christians tend to look at God's Word and ask ourselves some questions about it and say, well, why is this here? What is this part of the Bible about, and what's it here for? What am I supposed to gain, or what am I supposed to learn from this, and why is it here? And we look at things like the begats, so-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so begat so-and-so, and we wonder why is that there? Why do we have to have some of those things in the Bible? Why are they important? But God has placed everything that we find in the Scriptures there for a specific reason, and there are things there that sometimes we may simply not understand right now, but as time goes by, eventually, and with study, sometimes we do learn them, or sometimes we're enlightened about their meaning, and we come to understand them. And one of those things, some of those things that appear, may appear insignificant, they may appear peripheral or unnecessary, they all do have a purpose. And the sacrifices happen to be one of those things that people tend to look at in the Old Testament and shovel it aside because obviously Christ has come, so what, difference do they make? And what can we possibly learn from them? Well, actually, there's a lot that we can learn from them. We find a number of things that we can learn from them in particular. We can have a greater appreciation for how magnificent our God is and what he's done for us. But we also find some keys into what some of the things are that we will do as priests of God in his kingdom, present in them. Some of the clues that tell us a little bit more about what our future is. And last time I began this two-part series on actually Leviticus 1 through 7 is where the sacrifices are found. And we covered the introduction and we covered two types of the sacrifices. They were actually the first and the fifth one, I think, in your handout. I do have a few more in my briefcase. I don't know whether folks brought the handout from the last time or not. Some of you may. Some of you may not have it, but it might be handy to have. If somebody doesn't have one, why don't you raise your hand? I'll have somebody dig them out and pass them around. If you don't have one, I've got a few more in there I can pull out if anybody needs one. But if you have them, that's fine. I think they help us understand a little bit in terms of at least the handout helps us to understand the sequence of the of them and what their names are and just kind of a general idea of what they're all about. We covered the burnt offering and the meal offering last time, which are numbers 1 and 5 in the handout, which you can refer to again. In those two offerings, we see the perfect fulfillment of the law's requirements, both tables of the law. Christ fulfilling all of the law, basically, through the sacrifice, and hence establishing his righteousness. He is called the King of Righteousness in a number of places. And so we have covered the first and the fifth types because they fit together so well. This time I'd like to cover the other three that we did not cover, which includes the peace offerings, the sin offering, and the trespass offering. Those three I have not yet dealt with. I want to approach the peace offering first because it's probably of these three the least understood of the three that we're going to talk about today, so I'll spend just a little bit more time on it than I will on the other two. The peace offerings are perhaps the most difficult to define and for the Christian to really get a handle on or to fully understand. And so I'm going to do my best to explain them as we go through them. And I may repeat a few things in doing that, but in order to cover it all, I almost have to approach it in one way and then approach it another way, and so I may say some of the same things a second or third time as we approach them from different angles, because there is a different way to approach the peace offerings, or several different ways we could. The peace offerings are a sweet savor offering. to God, just like the burnt and the meal offerings were as well that we discussed last time. We covered last time as well, for those who might not have been here, two major categories of offerings or sacrifices. There is the sweet savor offering and there is the sin offering. Those are the two major categories. All of the sacrifices that are done in the Old Testament fall into one of those two major categories. They are either sweet savor or they are sin offerings. Sweet savor means that we are giving God what he truly wants, what he truly desires. And so it is a sweet savor to him. Not in terms of sacrifices themselves, the deaths of the animals, the shedding of blood, that is not what satisfies God. It is the meaning behind those sacrifices that is what satisfies God. And in fact, the peace offerings were burnt upon or right after the burnt offering that we covered last time. Quite frequently, they would do a burnt offering, they would do the meal offering, and then they would do the peace offerings immediately following. And then the last step would be to do the sin and the trespass offerings. Because the altar was in use a lot all day long. And realize, too, that the peace offering has nothing whatsoever to do with sin. Again, nothing whatsoever to do with sin. The distinguishing point is that some of the animal in the peace offering was offered to God, some of it was offered to the priest and his family, and some of it was offered to the offerer. And I would assume possibly the offerer's family, although the scriptures don't specifically specify that. At least it's not mentioned. I would assume it's the case that you, when you went in and made an offering yourself or you brought an animal to be sacrificed, that as a peace offering that God would allow you and your family both to participate in the process of the sacrifice as well. And that distinguishes the peace offering from all the other offerings. The other offerings did not share across the board any of the meat of the offerings with any other individuals. Fellowship and the eating of it obviously was what was being emphasized in the peace offering. Today we don't have sacrifices. So when, to God, the minister and the members, or when do God and when do the minister and when do the members all have time to fellowship together? What we're doing today, the Sabbath. This is an opportunity to come together before God, to share together sometimes spiritual food, to sometimes share physical food, but we can do both. Basically, the Sabbath and the holy days. These are our primary times of fellowship with God and with each other. These are pleasing times to God. Again, this is a sweet savor sacrifice. And this is often the missing element in just staying home and watching a DVD or going to the church website. We can't do all of the fellowship that is part of a normal Sabbath service. We don't have that opportunity to do that at home. And so God finds satisfaction in it. The priest and his family find satisfaction. And the offerer also finds satisfaction in this opportunity, in the fellowship and in the food. Each has a portion of it. And God is involved in our fellowship on the Sabbath. But there is one more dramatic item that struck me, I think, in all of this as well, as I was studying this and going through it. Typically, the portions of the animal sacrifices that God takes are the skin. He keeps the pelt or the feathers or whatever. They're not actually burned. They're not actually offered to him of this particular sacrifice. And in the case of birds, the fat, he also keeps the fat, the caul, which is that fatty area that, or flap that hangs over the liver in most of the animals, and the kidneys and the blood. Those are the things that God keeps. to himself. Those are never shared with anyone else in the offerings. Why? Those don't sound very appetizing, do they? Some people do. I mean, they call it kidney stew in England. That's one of their kidney pie, I think they call it. That's because they sometimes put a little bit of kidney in them with it, but it was mostly, I think, lamb that they used in a true kidney or English kidney pie. But most people don't eat, relish eating kidneys or, the blood of an animal or eating just fat from an animal or eating the skin. Now, sometimes I guess there's those people who like to eat the skin off of fried chicken and they really enjoy it. But, it really wasn't meant for us, I don't think, to eat it. It's not that appetizing to most people. So of all of those things that God keeps, some of those things are burned on the brazen altar. If a whole burnt offering is done, they would flay the animal, take the skin off, or if it was a bird, they'd pull the crop of feathers off, kind of skin it, so to speak, and then they would burn the animal. But the crop of feathers or the skin and some of those other things would then be taken outside the camp. They'd be dropped for the moment off the edge of the altar as they did this and as they killed the animal. But then normally those things would be taken outside of the camp and they would be burned on the ground. And all the other things were to be burned on the ground except, of course, the blood. The blood was to be collected and the blood would be used in some cases for some offerings. The high priest would stick his finger in the blood and he would sprinkle it before the veil within the tabernacle or within the temple, depending on the seriousness of the particular sin involved. And sometimes that's the case. But with the peace offering, it wasn't sprinkled. Sometimes it was put on the horns of the golden altar within the tabernacle or within the temple. And there were other cases. But then the rest of the blood would be poured out usually on the ground next to the brazen altar. The blood was either spilt or sprinkled, basically. None of these things would consider to be particularly edible or particularly satisfying or particularly desirable in terms of food. God doesn't need to eat anything, does he? As a spirit being, he doesn't need to eat. But these offerings in particular, God takes a portion of them in terms of the peace offering. Why does he take a portion? Well, for the first and only time among all of the sacrifices in the peace offering, God takes a portion, an edible portion of the meat, the rump or the flank steak, as we call it. Leviticus 3, verse 9, I think, is where it says that he takes that portion for his own. And, of course, if you've had it cooked properly, flank steak is absolutely delicious. Some people might not think so. If you've had it cooked right, it is really good. I had a deacon up in New York many years ago who cooked it for a Dells meeting we had over at his house one evening, and he did it on the grill outside, and it was fantastic, probably one of the best steaks I think I've ever had. And so God takes that particular portion of the animal, kind of like he takes the very last portion, right on the end, so to speak, for his own. Now, why would God take a portion of the meat for the peace offering? Because it was his intent and his desire to eat with and fellowship with his people. It was his desire to do so. God wanted to eat with ancient Israel within the court of the tabernacle. In fact, there are specific instructions. I think they're on your handout there as well. In terms of all of the sacrifices, any portions of the sacrifices were to be eaten in the or within the confines of the tabernacle there, or the what they call the court of the tabernacle. Had to be eaten there and no place else. Could not be taken home. Why would it not be able to be taken home? Because God was in the tabernacle or in the tent. He was there. He wanted to share it with his people. He wanted to eat with them. So And there are many reasons for that, and I think I talked briefly about it in one of the sermons that I gave not too long ago. But basically because of Israel's sins, God was not able to directly eat with ancient Israel. He would like to have. He wanted to. The Jews today at their Passover Seder meal reserve a chair for the coming or the future return of Elijah coming. Ultimately, God wants to sit down, and he wants to fellowship, and he wants to eat with his people, and he will do so at the marriage supper of his son in the future as well. In the peace offering, as in all of the offerings, God looked upon Christ as us. He's seen standing in as the individual offerer in some of the sacrifices we see, and or as the priest in some of the sacrifices, or as the church or the congregation in the wilderness. Christ stands in for his bride, the church that wishes to offer the peace offering because they're unable to do so. And Christ is the only one who can stand in. None of us can deserve to be the offerer. So Christ stands in, and we see him in these offerings and in the sacrifices as well. Even in the peace offering, if you look at, Paul tells us that in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Let me go look at this. I think I know where it's at. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Okay, verse 12. 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 12. He's talking about the church as the body of Christ. And he says in verse 12, "For as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ." See, he not only represented himself, but he represented the church as his body. In these sacrifices as well. We cannot have, nor do we deserve to have, communion with God the Father on our own. And Jesus Christ must step in to provide the opportunity for that communion or for that connection and fellowship. In some ways, we understand so very little about what Christ did and is doing that we derive very little comfort from what he's done, the kind of comfort we should be able to and need to have so badly. Sometimes it's because we just don't fully understand what he did. When we could derive a great deal more by understanding what he did, it would make it much more possible to receive the comfort from it that he meant for us to have. And the peace offerings are perhaps the least understood of all the offerings. But yet that's part of this comforting process that God has provided. Man is sustained by food. He made us so that we had to eat periodically. We had to drink. We needed to refresh and renew our system, so to speak. And the peace offering shows man sustained by God. That's what it is. We might call it comfort. We might call it sustenance. We might call it care or concern. But that's part of the meaning of the peace offerings. God offers it through Jesus Christ's sacrifice. And it's something we have to come to understand that that's what he did for us. If we look at it properly, when we have concern over whether God has accepted us as a human being, our chief desire will be to know that God is the one who's been satisfied, not us. That's part of serving. That's part of what our attitude toward God should be. That somehow, in some way, we have managed to please God by who we are and what we are and what we've done and how we're living. And that's what truly pleases God about the peace offering. You know, when we bring an animal to sacrifice, if we were in ancient Israel, it was to renew our relationship with God. It was to show our thanks to him. It was to show our praise of him in terms of the peace offering. If you brought a peace offering to God, that's what it was for. And he, in turn, took that animal, took a portion of the animal, gave back a portion of the animal to the priest and his family and to the individual offering, the offerer, so to speak, and probably his family, in order to comfort all and to provide satisfaction for all. Would it not provide the greatest satisfaction of all to know that God is pleased with you and your life? But of course, God isn't always pleased with everything we do. And so Jesus Christ is the one who has to step in as the peace offering on our behalf so that God can be pleased. If we could, you want to look at it another way, the peace offering attempts to satisfy this need of ours and also this need to satisfy God. That we want our Master and Creator to know that, or to feel pleased with us. Jesus Christ stood in to make that possible. Just as Abel's sacrifice pleased God, remember the story in Genesis? It pleased God. It wasn't the killing of the animal, it wasn't the shedding of the blood that pleased God. It was the attitude of Abel in offering the sacrifice that pleased God. It was Abel recognizing the fact that he desired to be accepted by God and for God to be pleased with him. Not because of the blood, not because of the animal, but because it was the attitude that Abel had in desiring for God to be pleased with him. Chapter 3 of Leviticus then covers the peace offering pretty thoroughly in general, and later the details follow, I think, in chapter 7. But chapter 3 is primarily the peace offering chapter. Today, most people in this world assume that the blood must be shed to keep the peace. People think of wars as an opportunity to bring peace. Kill people, shed blood, that will somehow bring peace. Yet often in the church, we make the assumption that that principle is wrong, don't we? In reality, all three of the peace offerings that are made are bloodshed offerings. They are the killing of an animal. Blood has to be shed. Yet we find that all three of these are blood sacrifices, and Christ had to die and to shed his blood so that peace can be had. What's the first thing that Jesus Christ has to do when he returns? Fight a war, doesn't he? Blood has to be shed almost immediately at his return. Otherwise, his kingdom cannot be set up. Peace cannot be had. He cannot become full king. Until those who are in rebellion and the armies or whatever that meet him when he returns have to be I don't want to say liquidated, but certainly there's going to be a lot of bloodshed. These armies are going to be destroyed. That has to take place in order for him to reign. Sometimes as Christians we don't look at the subject of peace in that way, but those are the facts. And those are the facts that are given as far back as Moses and the instruction on the sacrifices and the sacrificial system. Notice, too, that the main concept of the peace offering is fellowship with God, communion with God. God provides that fellowship in the sanctity of a meal together. The concept of the communion meal between man and God is present here, more than the other sacrifices. The concept of the Passover Seder meal in the New Testament, thinking of it is kind of like, or you might think of this as kind of like a Last Supper meal. What did Jesus Christ say at the Last Supper? With desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you. Because he was reflecting the peace offering. those words. He desired to eat it with his disciples. God is always providing food for us. And there is the wedding supper. There's the Passover service, bread and wine. There are the feast days. He made us to need sustenance. And in that partaking of food, there is fellowship in eating together. God's our provider, and he is providing the nourishment, and he's providing the sustenance that we need. The sacrifices and the feast days are opportunities to fellowship together and to eat together. That's what they were. These were opportunities for people to come in, bring an animal, have it sacrificed, and to eat a meal with the priest and with God. Even though they didn't realize God was probably figuratively eating with them, it couldn't eat right with them because of their sins at the time, he desires to do so, desires to do so today. The fact that God shares in this offering shows how valuable man is to God and how much he desires opportunity to fellowship with and to share himself with mankind. Christ said, "With desire I have desired to eat this Passover with you." And he meant that. And the Father, had he said it, would have meant it as well. He wanted to do the same with ancient Israel, but he simply couldn't because of their sins. He had not yet been offered, and the animal blood was inadequate for acceptance and for forgiveness of sin. Even the word atonement in the Old Testament had to do with simply covering up. There wasn't forgiveness of sin. There was a covering up of sin that took place with animal sacrifices and the blood of animals. God only allowed Israel to think that sins were covered by the blood of animal sacrifices until his son could be offered. And that's the case. Old Testament Israel felt that they were cleansed by offering an animal for their sins. And God wanted them, in a way, to come to understand that blood had to be offered for their sins as well. But it didn't really expiate sin. It appeared to expiate sin, but it simply covered it up until Jesus Christ's sacrifice could occur later, much later. This offering represents the body of Jesus Christ. That's what the peace offering is. And as such, it includes his walk, it includes his thoughts, it includes his strength, and it includes his affections. All of those things, his walk, his thoughts, his strength, his affections. The priest offering it represents Christ being sacrificed with his own suffering in the sacrifice. Turn over to Isaiah for just a moment. Isaiah 53, verse 11. Isaiah 53 and verse 11. It says, "He shall see of the travail of his soul." Jesus Christ will look at his own suffering and shall be satisfied. Concept behind the peace offering, sharing again. "By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities." He will look at his own suffering, the offerer. Jesus is sacrificed, and we see him take an edible portion of the offering as well. After Christ was resurrected, he would have been looking back at his suffering and success in all that he accomplished and been satisfied with his own performance. That's what Isaiah 53:11 is telling us. The priest's children and family are allowed to also share in this particular offering. Who do they represent? It's an interesting question. Leviticus 7, verses 31 and 32, and also Numbers 18, verses 9 through 11, talk about this in the priest's family. If Jesus is the priest or the mediator, then his family, his children, must be the church. But they are the church in one particular aspect. The church, or the bride, stands both to man and to God in more than one relationship. And we find a different emblem or type of each of those relationships. And we find a different emblem or type of each relationship throughout. And the different sacrifices have different emblems and different types involved in them. Just as we see Christ standing in four ways in the sacrifice, as God, as the priest, as the church, the body of Christ, and as the offerer. He stands in all four positions for us in the course of the sacrifices taking place. And we probably could say the children of the priests as the body of Christ. That is another way of looking at it too. She, the bride, is seen in service to God. In another relationship, she is seen in communion with God. So one time we see the children in communion with God, eating at his table. And another time, we see a relationship of the church with her God, with her husband, Jesus Christ. As Israel, the peculiar people of God, sometimes we see the bride in relationship with them as the seed of Abraham or the covenant people with God. As Israel, the peculiar people of God, there's all kinds of relationships there that I really don't even have time to approach. The Levites show us the church in service to God. They ministered to him. The family of the priests show as the church in communion with God as well. And this is what we see the children of the priest, you know, we see them eating at the table, the Lord's table, so to speak. If Christ is husband of the church, then the church is his family. That's another one of the things that we look at here. Therefore, the church shares in food of this offering through Christ, and the church as the bride of Christ also has various emblems of their functions too. The bride is a peculiar people, as we see in the scriptures. And the bride is also the covenant people. The bride is a service-oriented people, serving, ministering to God, to men, caring for the ark, caring for the altar, caring for the tabernacle. The Levites are doing all of those things, having the right to stand in the holy place where no one can see them except God. And here they are in communion or fellowship with God again. There's all kinds of interesting parallels and types found in the sacrifices. After the resurrection, we will be communing with God and offering sacrifices like our older brother Jesus Christ. And to find satisfaction as the priest's children in this offering, we need to understand our oneness with Christ as the offerer. Lots of symbolism in the analogy, and we don't have time to go into all of those, but I was just trying to point out a few of them to you so that you can kind of do a little study on that yourself if you want. As a Christian, we have nothing upon which to feed on with God in this offering except what Jesus Christ himself feeds on with God. We don't bring the sacrifice, so to speak. Christ has to bring the sacrifice. It's not even our animal, so to speak, although the individual brought the animal that was to be sacrificed. But we don't really have a way of sharing except by what Christ provides for us to share in. No matter how right or how righteous our experiences in life, our attainments, our righteousness, however you want to look at it, our walk or our service may be, they are not sufficient for the offering of atonement, nor can they ever be offered to be the ground of peace. We're simply not capable of that as human beings. And that's why Jesus Christ had to make that offering. And we see the two leavened cakes are offered. If you look at the Pentecost offering, we sometimes look at the two leavened cakes that were offered on Pentecost. They're mentioned in Leviticus 23 in the instructions in regard to Pentecost. Those leavened cakes on Pentecost were, and we sometimes visualize them as one cake was for the Old Testament Israel and one cake was for the New Testament church. That may well be true. They were leavened, so they could never be burnt on the offering or on the altar. Anything with leavening could not be burnt. But because they had leavening in them, that means that our fruits as a church are flawed because we sin. And so even our offering is flawed. Cannot be a perfect offering. Therefore, it cannot be burnt on the altar. Remember, the fire is God's holiness. The fire was not supposed to come into contact with leavening, was it? Ever. Or honey. And that's part of the symbolism involved. Our sacrifice, what we do, what we're able to do in terms of our works and our righteousness is simply inadequate. They were leavened, so they could never be burnt. But they were all the good deeds and the righteousness that the church and the people of God could muster together. So they were honored as part of a sacrifice, our sacrifice, but they could not be put before God. They are woefully inadequate, and they could not achieve atonement, nor could they achieve even an offering of peace. Or a meal offering without the intervention of our husband, Jesus Christ. To make atonement, there must be perfection in the offering. There are different grades that we find as well, different levels, modes, grades, whatever terminology you want to call it. There's a variety of modes of this particular oblation in particular. In some, the parts of the victim were seen to be discriminated. In other words, in some of the offerings, the animal was cut up into pieces. The head, neck, you know, chest cavity, you know, and so on. The animal was cut up on the altar, placed on the altar in a certain way. In others, this wasn't done. In grades of the offering, the animal was washed in water. In others, it was overlooked. In some, the offerer placed his hand on the head of the offering. In others, we don't see that. In some instances, the offerer kills the offering himself. In others, we see the priest kill the animal. So there are many different significant levels or grades within each one of these sacrifices as well. We also see different animals are offered at different grades or levels or modes within each of the sacrifices too. So there's a lot there to study. There's a lot to learn from each particular kind and grade and level of offering in terms of why and what's being emphasized. There are two major ways in which the peace offering may be given. Number one, it can be given for thanksgiving, or what we might call praise of God. And number two, as a vow, or a voluntary offering, or what we might call an act of service. Another way to look at it is that there are basically three types of peace offerings. I think they're listed there as A, B, and C. The first is the thank offering, and the thank offering was one of the general thanksgiving or general praise being offered to God. This was for unexpected blessings or unexpected deliverance in some way. The second, or B, is the votive offering. It was for the termination of a vow. Termination of a vow, or usually, and this vow was usually a vow of service of some kind to God. Or deliverance of some kind. that had already been delivered or granted, and it was made in support of the vow, made in petition to God for something. In other words, if a particular Israelite said, well, we see this huge Philistine army or this huge Midianite army out there, God, if you'll save us, I'll sacrifice a ram every week. I'll fast one day a week for the next whatever. And they make a vow to do certain things in service to God. The keeping of that vow would then be broken in the end after so many weeks of doing whatever. It would come to an end, and an animal would be sacrificed as an offering of a vow, or to close or to terminate that vow. But it symbolized service, basically. The thank or the free will offering emphasized thanksgiving or praise, and the votive emphasized service. So you have thanksgiving, praise, and service basically are the two types within, but there are three named in particular. The third peace offering was called the free will offering. Free will offering. And this was made in general for blessings from God, not specific necessarily, but or to express general thankfulness, praise, or love toward God. Grain and cakes could be offered with the peace offering as well. You could even bring leavened cakes, but they would be eaten by the priests, not offered on the altar, and no portion of them would be offered. Even leavened cakes as well, but no portion of them would be burnt on the altar, whereas some portions of everything else would be burnt on the altar as well. The priest would take whatever food, whatever grain offerings you brought, if they were not done with leavening and not done with honey, then he could take a small handful or portion of the grain or whatever it was that you offered, and he would burn it on the altar to God. And the rest would be eaten then by the priest and his family, or by the offerer and his family. The offering for praise or thanksgiving was directed to our service to God. The offering of the vow or the votive was directed to service to our fellow man. And so again, we see the first and the second great commandments, again being typified even in the peace offering. Service to God and service to man. Once again. When offered freely for praise, we see Jesus offering himself freely to God and or in service to him. Jesus didn't offer himself as a matter of service to God and man. He offered himself from first to last for God's glory. Okay, that's kind of what I've got on the peace offering. Now I want to talk about the sin offering. Take some time here and talk about the sin offering. The sin offerings are probably the most familiar of all of the offerings to us as Christians. The sin offering begins in chapter 4 of Leviticus. And if you want to turn over there, you kind of follow along if you're not already there. In order to understand the sin offerings and the symbolism involved in them, we need to understand something about the structure of the altars in the temple and in the tabernacle as well. And the symbolism of the blood and its being sprinkled on the altars and the fat, among other things. We'll talk about some of the symbolism of what does, well, we know the, you know, the blood symbolizes life. God put life into the blood. So what does the fat symbolize? Materialism. No, I'm just kidding. that might be our first reaction, but there are other reasons for that. It just came to mind as something that might be funny. The large brazen or bronze altar, as it was known, stood right outside of the tabernacle and outside of the temple during Solomon's day as well. But that large altar stood just outside of the tabernacle or the temple, and the priests would come out to it, and this is where they would actually kill the animal and sacrifice and offer it on the altar. And it was considered to be a type of God's table. That's one way to look at it. Or better yet, maybe a better symbol of it would be the stake or the cross upon which Jesus Christ was crucified. That's what the altar is. It is, and of course the fire, as I mentioned, is symbolic of God's holiness on this altar. So things that are burned up on this altar are offered to him and are burned up by his holiness. The outer court, where the brazen altar and the laver of water stood, represent the earth and the physical world with the work that is done in it toward God. The physical work done by human beings on the earth. And this is where the sacrifices and the work of Israel were carried out. The brazen altar was in the outer court, and any Israelite could walk into that court with an animal to offer, and he could touch the altar, even though the altar was sanctified. But because it's a physical representation of what's going on the earth, you know, the individual wouldn't be struck dead for touching it or being there. And any Israelite could walk into that court and make sacrifice. Although it was dedicated, it was not considered holy, and was not able to be defiled by any Israelite who happened to come into contact with it. Exodus 29, I believe, verse 36 through 43, talks about that and the fact that any of the Israelites could walk in with an animal and offer it to God at that point. The golden altar is different. The golden altar stood inside of the holy place. Sometimes inside of the holy place within the tabernacle or within the temple. And as such, the things in the holy place represent the heavenly places or the throne of God and the work of service taking place there before God. We know that presently the only priest that serves in that altar is Jesus Christ before God. Only the priests who represented Christ could enter the holy place and make offerings there. No Israelite could walk in there, or they'd be struck dead, basically, or stoned if they happened to have not been struck dead. The things in this area were holy. They could not be touched by the priests after they had washed, and only touched by the priests when they had washed themselves thoroughly in preparation to do so. We also need to understand the symbolism of the sprinkling of blood. It, of course, refers to atonement by sacrifice. And the sprinkling shows that the thing or the person sprinkled is being brought from a far distance from God to a state of nearness or relationship or communion with God or to God or before God. So you're being brought from far away to close. That's what the sprinkling process is all about. So when the brazen altar was sprinkled on, or a physical level of the altar was considered unapproachable by men at that point, because sin has separated them from it. In other words, that altar had to be sprinkled and cleansed again each time because human beings had again touched it. So the blood had to be sprinkled on the altar, and some on the altar, and some poured out beside the altar. And in some cases, it was poured down the sides of the altar for specific types of sacrifices. The same on a spiritual level, when we look at the golden altar of incense inside of the tabernacle, inside of the Holy of Holies, or the holy place, not the Holy of Holies. That incense altar was unapproachable except with the supreme sacrifice of Jesus Christ. No priest could approach it except acting as Christ. And the high priest or the priest of the day or the duty priest or whatever you want to call it who had to make sacrifice, certain sacrifices required that he come in with blood and put blood on the horns of the golden altar. Not just at atonement. Sometimes other sacrifices required that as well. But it was unapproachable by any other priest other than the duty priest that day or the high priest. no priest could approach it because none of, you know, only the one would be acting as Jesus Christ. So that was the only one who was permitted to touch it. Though priests approached it, they had to come as Christ or they too would die. Now let's talk about the blood a minute. Obviously the blood is, or the life is in the blood. God created us so that the blood gets oxygenated. The oxygen seems to prime and care for the needs of the cells in our body so that we live. Basically, without blood, you lose enough blood, you die. That's just the way it is. So the life is in the blood. But it is also symbolic of acceptance. So the blood or life belongs only to God. That's why we're not to partake of any of the blood. God says, don't eat the blood. Man has no share in the blood because it is life from God, and we don't have a right to partake of it. Let's talk about the fat. What does the fat represent? Why does God keep the fat to himself? Well, if we look at all the emblems of the body, we can probably see that what they represent pretty quickly. The head represents the thoughts. The legs represent our walk in life. The innards of the animal are representative of our feelings and affections of the heart. In fact, it was often thought in ancient days that your heart was down in here, and this is where your innards were, and that's where your affections of the heart came from. And so those organs were thought to be kind of the heart of the person for a long time. And those are the affections of the heart. So what does the fat represent? It's not obvious, but it represents basically the energy of the body. The energy of the individual, or the general health, or the vigor, or of the whole person, or the animal. The liver stores fat. Why does it do that? Because when you need extra energy, it burns the fat and turns it into sugar to give you the energy you need to walk around and to get and to become active. And this is why God keeps the fat for himself. Okay? The sin offering is the first of the not sweet savor offerings. Sin is not sweet to God, nor is the penalty that must be exacted for it. In the sin and the trespass offerings, we should pay special note to the offerer placing his or her hands on the head of the animal before it was sacrificed. This was symbolic in the substitution of the animal for the individual. In other words, this animal is taking on my sins, as the animal is about to be killed, so to speak. Although this hand laying did occur in most of the blood sacrifices, it didn't occur in all of them, not just the sin offerings. But it was here that we see the offerer emphasized, not necessarily the priest, not necessarily Christ in the offering, so to speak. When the blood is shed, the life is lost. And so the blood is sprinkled all around the altar to signify that justice has been served. Life has been lost for the sin involved in the lower classes or the lower grades of this particular kind of offering. In the higher grades or the higher classes of this particular offering, the blood was sprinkled before the veil, and it was placed on the horns of the golden incense altar within the holy place inside of the tabernacle or the temple. The remainder of the blood was then poured out at the base of the brazen altar outside of the tabernacle. The sin offering was offered for sins in general, not specific sins. Sometimes we think of it in terms of its specific sins, but it's not specific sins. In some ways, the sin offering is very much like the concept of baptism. We repent of our sins. All of our previous sins are lumped together and forgiven at baptism. our whole previous life, everything we did, all one lump sum, so to speak. Same way with Passover. At Passover, our sins are forgiven for the past year. All of the events, all of the things that we might have done, they're lumped together. That's basically the concept behind the sin offering as well. Why was the blood sprinkled before the veil and on the horns of the golden incense altar in some cases, but not in all cases? Well, there's probably at least two reasons. The Bible doesn't say specifically, but I can give you my conjecture about what the two reasons might be. Number one, our nature is a more serious problem or sin than are the things that we do or the fruits of that nature. Our nature is a more serious problem or sin than the things that we do or the fruits of that nature or the sins that we commit. Number two, some of the sins we commit only affect us and no one else. But some sins we commit may defile others. We may defile others who are priests. We may defile others, maybe in the entire the congregation of Israel, or maybe the entire church by what we do. These are clearly more serious and affect the relationship between God and the entire group, not just our individual relationship with God. So they have a greater impact. God's portion of these animals was always burnt outside of the camp in the case of the sin offering. But it was killed on the brazen altar, and the blood was spilled and collected there. The distinguishing difference between the sin offering and the trespass offering is often confusing to people, but it's easily understood, and I'll try to explain it the best way I can. The difference between them is that the sin offering was primarily for what man is. What man is. Our nature drives sin. We are not born with it, but we develop a carnal, sinful, selfish nature as we grow up. And in counseling young adults sometimes who seek baptism, who've grown up in the church, we often find it difficult for them to perceive or to fully understand what it is that they've done that is so bad. You know, I'd like to repent, but I've grown up in the church all my life. I've followed God's way of life all my life. What is it that I've done so bad that I have to repent? Sometimes that's the question that is asked by young people, and they simply don't understand. And in counseling them and trying to help them understand, it's not so much the individual little sins that you've committed along the way in your life. It's what you are, what we all are as human beings. It is our nature. A nature that leans towards sin, a nature that promotes sin, and that sometimes even seeks sin out. Now, let me talk about the trespass offering, because that kind of moves us into that one. The trespass offering begins in chapter 5 and verse 6 of Leviticus, if you're looking for it. I want to read Leviticus chapter 5, verse 15 to you as well, if I can get there. Leviticus chapter 5, I want to read verses 15, I think, and 16 in particular. If a soul commits a trespass and sin through ignorance in the holy things of the Lord, then he shall bring for his trespass unto the Lord a ram without blemish out of the flocks, and with your estimation of shekels of silver after the shekel of the sanctuary for a trespass offering. And he shall make amends for the harm that he hath done in the holy thing, and shall add the fifth part thereto, and give it unto the priest, and the priest shall make an atonement for him with the ram of the trespass offering, and it shall be forgiven him. The trespass offering was not a sweet savor offering either. Obviously, it's for sin. But rather expiatory in nature for specific sins. It was for a specific commitment of a particular sin or committing of a particular sin. Many have wondered why the difference or what, you know, what's the difference between the trespass or guilt offering and the sin offering. The sin offering was for sins in general, restoration with God and the congregation. They were unintentional sins. And as I said, the sin offering is what we is for what we are. But the trespass offering was for the fruit of our nature, the actions and the things we do and think that are the fruit of our nature, and that affects others or can affect others, doesn't always. But it is what man does. One is what we are or what man is, and the other is what man does. And that's the distinguishing difference between the two. When sins by us, without our knowledge or being aware of them, are committed, they are and they require a sacrifice in order to be forgiven. We all understand that concept. But often those actions of ours hurt others. If we steal, others suffer loss, don't they? Punishment of us does not satisfy their loss unless, as in the trespass offering, we're required to make good their loss plus 20% or adding a fifth to whatever they've lost. So if I was an Israelite and I stole a neighbor's or somebody out of town, I stole one of their bulls, just led it away and walked it home. And it was discovered what I had done. Then I had to go in and I had to make a trespass offering. But I also had to pay that individual the value of the bull plus 20% or plus one-fifth, and it had to be done in what was called the shekel of the sanctuary. In other words, the priests would decide what the value of that bull was, and they would set it in terms of the shekel of the sanctuary, which was considered the valid currency, so to speak, of God at the time. In other words, that it was true value that was being done for that particular animal. And the concept of restitution is also present in the trespass offering. You make restitution for what you've done, so to speak. So what thing of value, now, here comes the question having to do with the trespass offering. What thing of value could be given that was more valuable than all the debts, all of the injustices of all of mankind over all time? And how do you add a fifth part to it? Only the Creator himself, who made it all, was valuable enough to be sacrificed for all of those sins. Jesus Christ. The one who gave life in the beginning, the one who created the worlds to begin with, only he can offer himself as a far greater value in the trespass offering than anything else that any other human being could have done. And he's the only thing worth more than all the creation that he made. Different animals were specified so that anyone in Israel, from the richest to the poorest, could afford something to be given. The trespass or guilt offering concerned sins in respect to God and the holy things of the tabernacle, or sins that were injured, individuals who were injured by this particular sin, other people, or detracted from other opportunities to worship. In other words, any of those things that took place would be classified as a trespass offering or a trespass sacrifice needed. There was also a slight difference in the way the blood was used between the sin and the trespass offerings. The priest was to take the tip of his finger and dip it in the sin offering blood and sprinkle it near the veil, and then smear some of it on the horns of the golden altar of incense. Then the remainder of the blood was to be poured out at the bottom of the brazen altar. In the case of the trespass offering, the priest was to sprinkle it on the sides of the altar, sides now of the altar, pour out the rest at the bottom of the altar. But there was no sprinkling inside of the tabernacle or the temple. I'm not 100% sure why that's the case. I wish I knew. But there's a subtle difference there. But I would guess that the sin offering required this sprinkling within the tabernacle, within the temple, in the holy place, because it was for our nature. And it required far more of God's involvement in healing that nature than it did in terms of his simply paying the penalty for a particular trespass. The simple sacrifice of an animal for the sin committed. I mean, it was just the trespass offering was a simple thing to deal with compared to the sin offering. At least I think that's probably why, but I'm not 100% sure. The part of the blood that was collected was slung off of the priest's finger toward the Holy of Holies, but not inside the Holy of Holies unless it was the Day of Atonement. On the Day of Atonement, he would take that blood on his fingers inside and he would sling it onto the actual mercy seat of the ark. Much more serious, so to speak. Then it was sprinkled inside and the mercy seat. But it appears, although I can't be entirely sure, that the more severe the sin, the closer to the veil the priest slung the blood. But that's my opinion and my feeling about it. I don't know. But it seems to make sense, I guess, in terms of what we're seeing here. And it seems that our carnal nature is, in a sense, a higher degree of sin than some of the acts or the fruits of that nature. Some of the things we do because of that nature or its influence. That nature itself seems to be more severe, more of a problem than the individual acts that we commit. And the sprinkling seems to be almost an act of getting God's attention. How do I get God's attention to pay more attention to what's going on? The closer you sling the blood to the Holy of Holies or to the veil, the greater was thought, I think, the act of getting God's attention. So the more serious the sin appeared to be, the closer the priest would sprinkle the blood. That's my theory, my belief about why and when. And certain sins just simply weren't sprinkled at all. And certain trespass, or none of the trespass offerings were sprinkled, as far as I know. So it seems to be the seriousness of the level of the sin that has to do with that sprinkling process. If I might speculate a bit further, the priest was acting as the intercessor, Jesus Christ, in turning his back on the altar. Remember, he's walking away from the altar outside, walks into the holy place, and he puts the blood on the golden altar, on the horns or the corners of that altar. And then he approaches the veil, and he sprinkles the blood. All this time, he has his back to the altar. Keep that in mind. If we take that picture now to the moment that Christ died on the cross, what do we see? I think it perhaps reflects the fact that God the Father actually, as acting as high priest himself, turned his back on his son on the cross before the golden altar in heaven, sprinkled his son's blood on it, and sprinkled it before the judgment seat in heaven. And while he was doing this in heaven, at that very moment, Jesus Christ said, my God, why have you forsaken me? My theory, I don't know that that's necessarily correct or not. But God symbolically, I think, here turned his back on the combined sins of the world that were now on his son's shoulders at that point in time. best I can give you, that's my speculation on the matter as to why Christ maybe sensed that his father had turned his back on him. And he makes the comment that he does from the cross. You may have a different opinion. I'm certainly willing to listen. I don't know that my opinion is necessarily worth very much, but in light of our understanding of the sacrifices and all that went on, I think we see that picture present in what Christ was doing and what God the Father may have been doing in heaven at that moment. Sprinkling the blood of his own son toward the justice that needed to be served in heaven. The presence of the temple and Christ as high priest in the millennium here on this earth in Jerusalem is going to be something to see. It will have a powerful effect on mankind. It will become a powerful teaching tool to illustrate to mankind the cost of sin and the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and all that he really did. His plan for mankind and how that plan is progressing will be interesting to see. All of us look forward to that particular time. Just as the sacrificial system in ancient Israel was a very powerful mechanism for teaching them to understand more about what Jesus Christ would have to come and do later, it also was a powerful mechanism for Jews to be brought into the church in Paul's day. They could look at, I sacrificed animals all my life in the Jewish system. I brought them to the priests in the temple. Now I see why they did all the things that they did. Now that I understand, now that God's Spirit has shown me what was going on, they began to be easily converted as a result. And they began to understand what it was Christ did and what they'd been doing in the temple all of those years of their lives. That was a revelation, I'm sure, to many of them. We often wonder why the sacrifices will it be reinstituted again in the millennium. But the sacrificial system of the Old Testament is something that was a tremendous example to our predecessors, but also to us today. How much do you think ancient Israel understood about what they were doing? Those examples are for us, primarily. The sacrificial system of the Old Testament is something that was a tremendous example to us, not just to them. It provided a powerful educational tool which God is again going to use to influence human beings in the future, especially after the return of Jesus Christ and he establishes his kingdom on this earth. The sacrificial system of the Old Testament is something that was and is not and yet is and will be. It's interesting to look at it that way. I learned a tremendous amount about Jesus Christ and about God through the process of studying the sacrifices. You can too. And I hope these sermons will result in that for you.